Before he sent this article to Haaretz about a homosexual health tour in which he criticized the ruling by the High Court of Justice, I begged him not to do so, that he would not be disgraced by accusations that his opinions were conditioned by his advanced age. He was not persuaded. He was always ready to put up a fight about things he believed in. From the moment he entered the academic world, he was ready to argue with all comers about historical matters. He defended his historiographic conclusions against a large field of severe critics. He never took personal interests into account when it was a matter of science. His loyalty to his students was astounding, and he defended them like a father defends his children. To their faces, he would criticize their work with no hesitation, but he did not allow others to do so, nor did he allow his students to lock horns with one another. He was devoted to them, and they were to him. Katz's students came not only from the field of Jewish history, but also general history, education, sociology, Jewish philosophy, and political science, and many have taken up positions at leading universities around the world. Katz too taught at universities abroad, Harvard, Columbia, and Yeshiva. As he was an individualist and not a member of any cliques, he had to conduct his academic polemics alone on the battlements. One of his controversies was Baruch Kurzweil, whose frustration and criticism of the Hebrew University focused to a large extent on Katz personally. With his sharp and merciless tongue, Kurzweil tried to dwarf Katz's achievements. Katz returned fire on the pages of Haaretz sharply and courteously and had the upper hand. Katz's first book, Tradition in Crisis, in 1958, which describes the Ashkenazi life from the 10th to the 18th century, earned barrages of criticisms from his colleagues at the Hebrew University, who questioned the validity of the book. The criticism jeopardized his academic standing, but he rebuffed all critics. The book was published in many editions in a number of languages and became a basic text for the study and research of medieval and modern Jewry. Katz outlived his critics and established a central position amongst Judaic scholars in general and historians in particular. His candidacy for the Israel Prize was put off a number of times, and he was a laureate only after he reached the age of 75 in 1980, at the behest of his students, who did not rest for the prize of which he was so worthy. "Do your work and honor will follow," Katz used to say. Meanwhile, his theses on a number of central issues in Jewish history have become canonical. May the memory of our beloved teacher be blessed. A very nice obituary. I can only add my own personal and enormous admiration and respect for him. The contacts that I had with him over the years have just been extraordinarily beneficial to me. Okay. All right, now let's go on to the topic.
Didn't Chaim Soloveitchik get his PhD?
Yes, he was his student. Yes. Okay. So now let me, for the people who weren't here last time, to briefly review what we did last time. And we began by studying a couple of passages in the Gemara. One passage in the Gemara mentioned the prohibition against the study of Greek wisdom, presumably Plato and Aristotle and company, Greek philosophy, but also mentioned that those people who were close to authority were allowed to study this in order to be able to participate in the court. And it was amusing to see that the Meiri took this little loophole of a person who is a courtier or a politician by profession and said that all Talmudic scholars fall into the category of being karov l'malchut, because after all they have to defend the ideas of the Jewish religion against various attacks, and therefore the study of philosophy was permitted to them. So this was the position of a person who was primarily a halachist, namely the Meiri, but was of a rationalist temperament. On the other hand, the position of someone who was primarily a philosopher, but the greatest and the leading halachic authority, was quite the reverse. The Rambam, in a whole list of citations which we read last time, pointed out that the study of physics and the study of metaphysics were religious obligations. That in order to be able to fear God and to love God, we can only understand God by studying his creation, and then after understanding physics, we can pass on to the study of God himself, which can only be achieved by philosophy. and therefore the study of philosophy was not only permissible to people who had actually studied the halacha, but it was a religious obligation. More than that, the Rambam earned the ire and the wrath of the proponents of halacha as an object of study by taking the phrase in the Gemara on Sukkah, which describes Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai as having been educated in all fields, including small matters and great matters, davar katan v'davar gadol, and the Gemara says davar katan is havayot da'abaye v'rova, that is, small matters means legal disputations, and davar gadol is ma'aseh merkava. And the Rambam interprets davar katan to include all Talmudic study, and davar gadol, ma'aseh merkava, he interprets as the study of metaphysics. Therefore, according to the Rambam, one should spend as little time as possible on Talmudic studies, get it out of the way, and then devote yourself to your true religious obligation of study, which is the study of physics and metaphysics. And as we saw, the Rambam, in his introduction to the Yad HaChazaka, explicitly says that his purpose in writing this particular book is that after he's written this book, a person need merely study the Bible, that is the Tanakh, and then pass directly to this book, and he doesn't have, namely the Rambam's composition, and he doesn't have to read anything at all in between. And we saw that this, of course, so his purpose, one of his purposes in writing his magnum opus was to eliminate the study of the Talmud from the curriculum.
Metaphysics, is that just a synonym for philosophy?
Well, it's that part of the philosophy that deals with the nature of God. That is, it's in the Aristotelian corpus, it's what happens, what you study after you've mastered physics. But yes, it's philosophy. It's the philosophical approach to the study of religious problems. That's how the Rambam interprets Ma'aseh Merkava.
So then I'm a little confused. Wasn't the Rambam serious about the oral law?
Is it just he was serious about the oral law.
But yet, if he's saying that studying the Gemara isn't as important as the metaphysics...
Right, because he says the oral law is very important because you have to know what to do. You have to be able to come to decisions in practical matters. If you have a case between two litigants coming before you and you're a judge, you have to be able to decide the case. If someone asks you a question in Hilchot Shabbat, you have to be able to know the answer. But that's not what you should be spending your time at. You should master all of that material by reading his book, for example, and then pass on to more important objects. So for the Rambam, the commandment to study, and the Gemara, which says that a person should divide his time into three equal portions, a third to the Torah Shebichtav, a third to Mikra, in other words, and a third to Mishnah, and a third to Gemara, the Rambam says that's at the beginning of your studies, but after you manage to go through the curriculum, then most of your life should be devoted to the study of philosophy. And in fact, the Rambam goes even further and sort of tries to reinterpret Gemara to mean philosophy. That is, so that the Rambam is quite clear, and if you like, we can reread all of the selections, but the selections that we read last time were quite explicit on this point. And naturally, for this reason, those particular chapters of the Yad HaChazaka were suppressed from the study in the yeshivot in Eastern Europe and in other places. Okay. And let me remind you that we read last time both the outrage of both the Rashba and the Ran on this point. The Rashba said, "Behelokim yechaper," that may God forgive anyone who wrote such matters, and the Ran said that he wrote things that should never have been written. Both used an extremely sharp language in criticizing the Rambam's view on this point. At the other extreme, I'm reminding you from last time, is the position of the Ramban. The Ramban not only claimed that the study of science wasn't a religious obligation. According to the Rambam, the study of science is part of a religious obligation to love God. One can only love God by studying his creation, and the study of the creation means the study of physics, and therefore there was a religious obligation to study science in order to be able to appreciate God's handiwork. The Ramban, on the other hand, says that anyone who believes in the existence of a concept of nature or natural law or normal course of events or normal or natural ordering of the universe cannot be a member of the Jewish faith. Because one has to believe that everything that occurs every day of your life is a mythic miracle. Maybe a hidden miracle because you're accustomed to it, but your attitude towards life has to be one of thorough dependence on God and no intermediating factors such as a system of laws or laws of physics or anything of this nature. So therefore, from the quotation of the Ramban that we learned last time, we read last time, not only is the study of science or philosophy not a religious obligation, but it runs counter to the very fundamental principle of religion, which is to believe in the unmediated action of God in our daily lives without any system of natural laws. Another thing that we mentioned last time is that all of the medieval philosophers, whether it's the Rambam or the Ralbag or any of the others, or even Ezra, took for granted that the science of their day was complete. The Rambam, on occasion, disputes Aristotle on matters of astronomy. But anything that's happening below the lunar sphere, in other words, all of biology and all of physics, because after all, in the Rambam's time, astronomy was not a part of physics, all of that, Aristotle is 100% correct. There is no doubt in the minds of the medieval philosophers that the universe, their intellectual universe, was one which is completely static. They could not imagine a historical view of the universe, and they certainly couldn't imagine that the laws of nature, as formulated by the ultimate authority, namely Aristotle, could be in any way be wrong. Now, I'm always happy to quote the Rashba, even though my colleagues, like Professor Langerman, think that I'm overdue to give too much credit to the Rashba, not enough credit to his antipathy to science, but let me remind you of a famous tshuva that the Rashba has. The Rashba we've studied this tshuva maybe a dozen times over the last 40 years, but it's always worth repeating. It's a famous Rashba having to deal with, in which he deals with talismanic medicine, astrological medicine, which was just coming into play at the end of the 14th, or the middle of the 14th century. And the issue was whether or not it's permissible according to Jewish law. Let's not go into the technical details, but the Rambam gives two contradictory interpretations to the Gemara in Shabbos, which says, Kol sheyesh bo mishum refuah, ein bo mishum darkei ha'emori. There's a prohibition against superstitious practices, but the Gemara says, all phrases, I quoted it exactly, Kol sheyesh bo mishum. Medicinal doesn't fall under the rules of superstition. Now, of course, what does that mean? What does it mean, kol sheyesh bo mishum refuah, ein bo mishum darkei ha'emori? And the Rambam offers two contradictory explanations of this phrase, but the Rambam's two contradictory explanations, of course, exactly the positions that we would take today. One of his explanations is that the word refuah in that passage means science. That's sort of a stretch, but he interprets kol sheyesh bo mishum refuah means that anything that has a basis in biology, if we understand the biological mechanism by which this particular medication is going to work, then it's not superstition. So if you ask what's the difference between a witch doctor performing medicine or the current practice of bringing doves and putting them on your belly for curing of, what is it?
Hepatitis
and stuff of this nature. As this has no scientific explanation, it doesn't fall in the category of kol sheyesh bo mishum refuah.
So I mean, whatever works?
No, he didn't say it. This is one explanation. One explanation is that something, in order not to be superstitious, has to have a scientific basis. We should understand what the scientific reason for its working is. In other words, if you give someone penicillin, you know that it works because you know the effect that this particular drug has on the bacteria and so on. So you have a theory. You have a theory, a germ theory of disease, and then a theory which tells you that this particular extract kills the bacteria, and therefore, and so on and so forth. So, or?
I haven't taken biology since grade 9 in high school, but I think they said that aspirin, people don't know how it works.
Right, so then the Rambam has an alternative explanation. Another explanation that the Rambam gives for kol sheyesh bo mishum refuah ein bo mishum darkei ha'amori is exactly that one, namely something which has an empirical basis, it's been tested empirically, even if we don't understand why it works.
So then it's not a superstition anymore.
Therefore, I think that this would be exactly how we would approach the problem today. The way we would distinguish between herbal cures and other forms of superstitious medicine and or pigeons on the belly and other forms of superstitious medicine and actual medicine would be either because we understand how it works, even though the empirical evidence...
But you could always make claims.
Anyone can make a claim, so therefore... If it fits within a scientific scheme, then it's not superstition. Or if it's been empirically tested by carefully guarded experiments, and you've verified that it works, then it's also not superstition. But a mere claim or a mere...
What about the placebo effect?
All of those things have to be brought into our current understanding of what it means, what empirical verification means, right? And the Gemara and the Rambam are well aware of the placebo effect. But I don't want to concentrate on this issue of empirical verification. The Rashba attacks the Rambam as to how can you have two such contradictory explanations of what the word refuah means. And of course for us that's perfectly fine to have such a contradiction. But the Rashba then goes on to attack him as to what he means by scientific explanation. And this is what he says. Od yesh li makom hiyun b'divrei harav zal. I also have another problem with what the Rambam says. Anything that is explained by scientific investigation, by natural investigation, is permissible, and the others are not. And I raise the following problem. What is the definition of scientific explanation? Does that mean only what is written in those scholars who wrote books about nature, like Aristotle or Galen and their company? And anything that they didn't achieve should be regarded as superstition. Have they achieved all possible scientific knowledge? Does the nature of scientific investigation come to an end with Garrett, Galen, and Aristotle? This is certainly something which is unacceptable to any thinking man. Things which act via an occult quality don't do so because of something which is beyond nature, but because nature contains occult properties. Remember, the Peripatetics, Aristotle in particular, denied the existence of anything that could be a property of a body that was not observable to the five senses. The non-existence of occult qualities was one of the principal themes of Aristotle. For example, consider the attractive stone. Shahabazel kofetz aleha. V'yotel mizeh mulgal b'yordei hayam ba'aniyot tochdim machat b'chatichat eitz tzaf al pnei ha'mayim u'mar'in lo even v'yishot al pnei ha'mayim ad shi'ifne al pnei ha'sadam. After all, consider the fact of the mariner's compass, which was recently introduced into Europe at that time. Here you have something where you put a magnetized needle on a cork close to the middle of
dish of water, and it points to the North Pole. This is in complete contradiction to anything that Aristotle would have allowed. So obviously Aristotle didn't know everything, says the Rashba, and therefore he's attacking the static view of knowledge of the universe, which of course was underlying the philosophical position of the Rambam. And on that the Rashba is 100% correct. In fact, in the history of science, the undermining of the Aristotelian position came a couple of centuries later, but primarily from, say, someone like Gilbert's book on the magnet, and so on. In other words, the study of electricity and magnetism was one of the crucial themes in overthrowing the Aristotelian position. But in any event, the Rashba was ahead of his time, I think, on that particular issue. And let me also remind you of what we read last time, which was the position of Rabbi Elio Mizrahi, who says that indeed the philosophers interpret davar katan to mean the study of halacha, and davar gadol to mean the study of philosophy, because the halacha studies the laws of God, and philosophy studies the nature of God. But the mekubalim as well distinguish between davar katan and davar gadol, namely, according to the Kabbalists, davar katan again means the study of the law, but davar gadol means the study of Kabbalah, because only thereby can you come to the study of God. And let me remind you of the marvelous quote that we had last time from the Zohar, which treats the study of halacha as penal servitude, right? The Zohar specifically says, "Vayimaharu et chayehem b'avodah kasha." They embittered their lives with forced, hard labor. Zu kushya. That's what a kushya is. B'chomer d'akal b'chomer. U'bilveinim d'alibun halacha. V'chol avodah b'sadeh d'abraita. The study of the braita, it means out, work it out in the field. Et kol avodatam asher avdu b'hem b'parech. All of the extra work that they had to heavy burden that they had to bear, doth take. In other words, the Zohar's attitude towards the study of the Gemara was equally negative. Okay, so we have this strange melange. And on the one hand, we have the disagreement between the mystics, Mukubalim, and the rationalists and the scientists. And let me point out that this fight between the mystical perception of nature and the scientific perception of nature is not limited to a fight between religious authority and secular authority. I'll quote two relevant passages. Here is on the one hand, many of the great scientists felt that they were working within the religious tradition, namely worshiping God by studying his nature. Here's a quote from a recent lecture by John Brook on the on science and religion. "The mathematical laws governing planetary motion, formulated by Kepler and later embraced by Newton, have often been seen to imply the exclusion of a deity from the clockwork universe. But this is not how Kepler or Newton saw them. On recognizing an elegant correlation between the period of a planet's orbit and its mean distance from the sun, Kepler confessed to being carried away by the inevitable rapture at the divine spectacle of heavenly harmony. For the secular philosophers of the French Enlightenment, Newton's science may have implied an autonomous universe. But for Robert Boyle and Newton himself, clockwork images imply fine engineering and a degree of cosmic maintenance. Newton's God used comets' tails to replenish matter lost by the sun through evaporation. Nor have the so-called implications of science always favored the secularists. With a successful rebuttal of claims for spontaneous generation, Louis Pasteur was able to launch a public attack on materialism and atheism." So that on the one hand, it's not always true that the conflict between science and religion has the scientists decide against religion. And on the other hand, the antagonism towards science doesn't necessarily stem from religion. For example, I'm quoting a couple of poems that are quoted by this really bad book by Dawkins, but the poems are good. Here's a very famous poem of Blake. To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. That's very famous. But slightly less famous, but still well-known poem of Blake is, for Bacon and Newton, sheathed in dismal steel, their terrors hang like iron scourges over Albion. Reasonings like vast serpents enfold around my limbs. So you see that Blake had no use for science. Or Keats, do not all charms fly at the mere touch of cold philosophy? There was an awful rainbow once in heaven. We know her woof, her texture. She is given in the dull catalogue of common things. Philosophy will clip an angel's wings, conquer all the mysteries by rule and line, empty the haunted air, agnomed mind, unweave a rainbow. So the antagonism that existed in the period of the Romantic poets, say, at the beginning of the 19th century towards science doesn't necessarily stem from any religious motivation whatsoever. Okay. Now let's get back to Katz's tracing of the history of the obligation for study. What is the commandment of Talmud Torah, which we saw in the time of the Rambam and the Ramban was the study of philosophy or the study of Kabbalah. And he quotes from various sources. Let's read some of his quotes in the original. Let's go to my page 327 from Maaseh Eifod. So this is a book written at the very beginning of the 15th century, 1403. Look at my page 327, for example. Duran argues.
Do you have some more
handout? Are there any more left?
Yeah, I can share.
Did you didn't bring yours?
I didn't bring mine.
All right. So, Duran, in his day, cites three attitudes towards what the matter, what the curriculum of study must be for the fulfilling the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. The three groups being the halachists on the one hand, the philosophers on the other, and the kabbalists on the third. So on my page 327, he writes, Hakata achat ba'alei chachmata Talmud. The first group is the group of Talmudic scholars. Ritzoni ha-chachamim b'chibur hazeh ha-mufursam, those who are scholars in this well-known document, asher chibro av ashi v'hu ha-mava'er chibur ha-mishnah, which explains the Mishnah, asher l'rabbeinu ha-kadosh ha-mutzi l'or ta'almuteh al derech ha-chakira ma'amasa v'ha-matan b'en chachmei Yisrael ha-mufursamim. כי בו בו מן העומק משהו מפורסם אצל מי שזכה לשוט במי חכמתו, וההתחתנות הזה והחקירה הזאת לפי דעתם מביא אדם אל הצלחתו האחרונה. The study of the Gemara in its various detail will bring a person to his ultimate achievement. וזוכה בו למעלת החכמים בגן עדן, and he will therefore reach the level of a scholar in paradise, כפי שיעור מה שיגע בחכמו או פלפל בה. When God meets him after his death, he's going to be asked, did you get involved in wisdom? But the study of the Gemara has, no, there's nothing greater than this. V'inyan hamidahu ha-toa ha-chashur va-ha-toa ha-chashur u-kinyan le-nefesh. אשרו התחלה, וממנו יצאו הפעולות החשובות והטובות. ועליו אמרו, אשרי מי שבוא לכאן ותלמודו בידו.
So that's a description of the first group. Then he has, if I turn to my page 328, Falsafim, those are the Torah scholars who engage in philosophy. Those who follow the philosophers like Aristotle, and they were also followers of the Jewish religion, and they want to combine these two opposites. That the ultimate in human perfection is the study of logic and physics and the study of God and theology. And this is the tradition that we get from the Greek sages, and these are indeed the secrets of the Torah. The study of nature is what is called Maase Reshit, and the theology, that is the metaphysics, Maase Merkava, Vahem Sabilta Torah, Asher Yasira Chachamim, Michakar Layem Kim, Betnaim, Vidyat Kolze, Musibati Shavot, and Tzchi, Lenefesh, Betseitam, and Akoach El Hapoach. And this is the only form of immortality when the intellect goes from the potential to the actual. Vikinyan Muskale Elu Hadvarim. This is the acquired intellect, and so on and so forth. And then he describes also the third group. Next page, my page 329. They believe that the Kabbalah is something which we got from the patriarchs, and the Moshe, the Cholan, the Yim, the Chol Chachmei Yisrael, the Chayhem, Zeh Achazeh, the Hi Chachmah Kolel, the Sardot, the Elohut, the Amalakish, the Yim, the Chlaim, the Elohut, the Tiviyut, the Mashe, the Sartor, the Mnaat, the Derech HaChakira, and various things which cannot be achieved by rational investigation. Avali Chachmah Yidua, the Kabbalah, Gila Hashem Sodo, So those are the three competing positions at the end of the 14th century, the beginning of the 15th century, and Prophet Duran rejects all three in favor of his fourth position, which nobody accepted, which is to return to the study of the scriptures themselves, namely the study of the Bible. Okay, so that brings us up until the end of the 14th, beginning of the 15th century. And now let's pass to what happened at the end of the 16th century, that is the time of the expulsion from Spain. And for this, it will be simpler for me to read from Katz's summary rather than from the Maasei photo, although you have the original in the handout.
This is from where it passes.
So I'm now reading from Katz's article, Halacha and Kabbalah as Competing Disciplines. We have that in the book, so I didn't have to pass this out. Prophet Duran's casual testimony concerning the increasing esteem enjoyed by the Talmudic studies among Spanish Jewry of his day is corroborated by Rabbi Yosef Yafet's observation on the situation at the time of the expulsion. The latter asserts that never before had Spain been as full of yeshivot and their students as it had been at that moment. With students divided into several groups, some would spend 6 or 7 years with the great rabbis, sharpening their minds like a razor. This phenomenon, however, was seen by Yavetz in essentially negative terms, for he felt that such intensive study had failed to achieve its desired end of practice and piety. His judgment of his generation, colored by the experience of decrees and expulsion it suffered, is framed in categories of innocent and guilty. The former, in his opinion, consisted of naive believers who sacrificed their lives for their faith. In contrast to the latter, the intellectuals, maskilim, whose learning may have been Talmudical or philosophical,
although his ire was directed primarily at those addicted to philosophy, which he regarded as responsible for weakening the faith of his generation, the Talmudists were not free from blame. Their excessive involvement in Pilpul, he claimed, prevented them from attaining the Torah's ultimate end. Furthermore, most of them were not religiously motivated in their study. Therefore, they were not able to defend their generation, by which he meant they did not serve as a model of self-sacrifice to the masses when they were put to the test. The question that arises from such a description is, where were the Kabbalists, master of that which he saw the higher wisdom to which we might adhere to this great name? Yet elsewhere he indicates that he did not regard Kabbalah as necessary knowledge, seeing the revelation of its secrets rather as a reward awaiting the pious in the next world. In fact, it is unclear whether Yavetz himself was well-versed in his teaching. Hardly a trace of them is evident in his sermons or commentaries. Nevertheless, Rabbi Yosef seemed to have shown an interest in spreading the Kabbalah publicly. Be that as it may, in his description of pre-expulsion Spain, he mentioned those intellectuals entirely lacking in this wisdom, the Kabbalah, who scoff at it and at its scholars. In his critique of the generation's leadership, however, the Kabbalists are not presented as a group elevated above the rest, whose behavior could also serve as a model to the masses. So, in the opinion of Rabbi Yosef Yavetz, all three of these categories, who were described by Duran, didn't measure up to the needs of the tragic generation suffering expulsion from Spain and forced conversion. Now, let's pass to 50 to 100 years later and what was happening in Tzfat. For an excellent historical overview of Tzfat in the time of Rabbi Yosef Karo and the Ari, Rabbi Yitzchak Gloria, and Rav Chaim Vital, and Rav Noshe Karavero, I've given you the article by Solomon Schechter, which is an excellent overview of the structure of the town and its principal scholars, in particular his stories about the Machaber and his angel who was giving him direction, and of the other many of the other principal characters is pretty interesting. Let me, however, again, read from Katz's summary. In the competition, so I'm reading from page 7. In the competition between Halacha and Kabbalah for the attention of the students, the latter, that is the Kabbalah, was initially at a disadvantage. The study of Talmud, which at the beginning of the century was quite undeveloped in Eretz Yisrael, received a powerful push forward with the arrival of Rav Jacob Beirav in Tzfat during the 1520s. Beirav brought with him the analytic methods of Iyun, which had been developed in the academies of Spain during the final generations before the expulsion. This method guided the student in the detailed analysis of the discussions of the Talmud and its commentaries on the basis of clearly defined and articulated principles. It gave students a methodological tool for active study, permitting them to develop novel interpretations while engaged in dialectical debate. Something that was done through the regular group study of students in the advanced academies. On the other hand, with the advent of Moshe Cordovero, the Ramak advises those of the first type, that is, to get themselves in the habit of studying some pilpul as far as they can understand it, as well as some Mishnah, Talmud, and the root of the Tzahalacha, so they should not be akin to one who gazes at the stars and pays no attention to the ditch that lies beneath his legs. The order of study is presented here in inverse order. Pilpul, that is the give and take of the halakhic debate, is actually the final rather than the initial stage. It is necessary, however, to introduce them to the habit of thinking abstractly, a precondition for studying Kabbalah, so they may not come to attribute corporeal properties to things celestial. In practice, therefore, Ramak was willing to be satisfied with little. The student of Kabbalah must acquire the basic rudiments of exoteric knowledge so that the gates of the esoteric may be opened before him. In Cordovero's apology for continued esoteric study, notably absent is the recommendation to strive for novel interpretation. In other words, the idea that you should be original in halakhic enterprise is missing. The higher achievement Notably absent is the recommendation to strive for novel interpretation, the higher achievement of those who distinguish themselves in the halacha. His creative abilities and those of others like him were now channeled towards the world of mystery. Justification for this tendency was provided by placing Kabbalah uppermost in the scale of Torah studies. I believe that signs of the shift are evident in the religious culture of Safa during its entire golden period. It excels in the realm of halacha, in the great codifying enterprise of Yosef Karo, the Beit Yosef and the Shulchan Aruch, and in the rich response to literature. These constitute a kind of cross-examination of the sources in order to determine on their basis the norms of individual and communal conduct. If, as a consequence of the codifying efforts, halachic novellas emerge, these were simply a byproduct of the process. Actual Talmudic novellas constitute only a small fraction of Seifert's literary cultural productivity. Codification is, at base, static in character. The dynamic element in the religious culture of Safa during its golden period is represented by Kabbalah and the ethical homiletic literature and poetry that were influenced by it. It is hardly surprising that they place their distinctive stamp on the image of the period as it was portrayed both within Jewish tradition and in modern historiography. Now he turns to the Ari. The general characteristics of Safed's culture during this period apply also to the individual considered by later generations to be its leading representative, Rabbi Isaac Luria. As a student of Rabbi David ibn Zimra and a kind of disciple colleague of Rabbi Saul Ashkenazi, the author of the Shita Mekubetzet, in the compilation of which Luria took a small part, he was capable, upon moving from Egypt to Safed at the age of 36, of assuming immediately the position of head of a yeshiva. Of his standing in Safed and also of his accomplishments in the realm of Halacha, we may learn from a query and responsum which passed between him and Joseph Caro. The question turned on a business matter, the amount due one who had invested money with another so as to receive half the profits when the latter active partner died while transferring the goods overseas, in which Luria himself was evidently involved. When Joseph Caro addresses him in terms of great respect, but finds serious fault in his interpretation of the words of Maimonides. He furthermore accuses Luria's general argument of lacking internal logic, which led Caro to exclaim, "I wonder about the soundness of your reason." And in fact, Katz adds, a close analysis of Luria's comments on the subject reveals that he is generally well-versed in halachic concept, but nevertheless not quite up to precise halachic thinking. This degree of familiarity with the sources was sufficient for gaining recognition as a Talmud Chacham. It would certainly have been inaccurate to describe every person who taught Torah publicly as a profoundly learned scholar. Those who actually attained the sovereign mastery of the concepts of halacha and its winding paths of thought were few in number, and there's no sign that Luria ever joined their ranks, or even aspired to do so. It appears that his exoteric study was carried out essentially as the fulfillment of an obligation. His mind was preoccupied with the pressing problems of the Kabbalistic thought, and it is likely that he did not cease to long for the world of the esoteric even when he was involved in exoteric study. What effect did this new ritual baggage have on the actual intellectual process of study? According to one tradition, each day Luria would explain a law six ways on the level of pshat, parallel to the six profane weekdays, and then would explain the same law in a seventh secret manner in honor of the Sabbath. It is difficult to imagine, Katz says, that a study method of this sort was consistently maintained. Whatever the case, efforts to subordinate study to any superimposed schema or to require the student to cultivate special intentions not related to the subject could only have had a detrimental effect upon concentration in straightforward study. And let me then skip to the end of Katz's article. He then goes on a century further down the line to Rabbi Isaiah Horowitz, the Shalach, who after all started out as a Rosh Yeshiva in Europe, a very distinguished halachic scholar, and then finally passed into the Kabbalistic realm. And we have his famous book, Shnei Lukot Avrit, from which we quoted last time, where he says that the masters of the Kabbalah are worth 10 times as much as the masters of the halacha. But now let's pass to the final section in Katz before we go back to the original origins of this problem. Rabbi Isaiah, that is, the Shalom, Rabbi Isaiah's method was able to forestall the displacement of exoteric by esoteric study. Although the Kabbalah was recognized as the necessary source for understanding the essence of the Torah and the commandments, the place of halachic study, according to the principles of the method, remained secure. Nevertheless, it is a fact that the absorption of Kabbalistic ideas on a broad scale from the second half of the 17th century on is paralleled by a relaxation of the previously intense cultivation of Talmudic study. The flowering of a halacha in Poland, Lithuania, and even Bohemia, Moravia reached its peak during these generations. There are clear explanations for this phenomenon. The decrees of 1648, 1649, and the disasters that followed in their wake, the withering of a council of lands, and a decline in the economic and organizational power of the communities, this at a time when the yeshivot were institutionally supported and supervised. It is distinctly possible, however, that unseen forces played a role in this process as well. Recurring demands that the students not limit themselves only to halacha on account of its being insufficient, if not complemented by Kabbalah, undoubtedly lowered the stature of the Talmudists. At the same time, preachers devoted considerable efforts to encouraging scrupulous self-examination for sins, arousing as well a profound yearning for purification through acts of repentance, according to the teachings of the Kabbalists. The study of Torah ceased to be regarded as a sufficient means for gaining favor in the eyes of God. This process of putting aside Talmudic study as a consequence of finding greater satisfaction in more emotionally charged religious activity was...